think I have lived close to 25 years of my life now in New England. Most of that here in New Hampshire, some of it up in Maine. And in some of those years, like this one, I'm going to switch mics here. That way I don't have to listen to myself whine. I was saying, in those 25 years, in some of those years, like this one, we'll get a relatively mild winter. And I'll come into March thinking, well, maybe we snuck through it this time. Especially when we've had a run of warm weather like we did some time ago. I find that whenever I start thinking along those lines, I end up like Charlie Brown after Lucy yanks the football away. You know that ongoing image there. I think, okay, this time this year, we really did get up easy, and spring has really and truly arrived. And then wham, I'm pulling out the snowblower and blowing up again, bundling up again. Like poor old Charlie Brown, who keeps taking the bait, no matter how many times Lucy yanks the football, I seem to never learn. So I began preparing my 2007 Easter Sunday service and sermon this past week after, as I know a number of you did, clearing several inches of wet and very heavy snow out of my driveway, knowing that I had fallen on my head once again. But it is spring, apparent or not. The earth does awake again, and the circles and the cycles of life, death, and rebirth that have been going on since well before our first human ancestors showed up on this planet continue to run their course. And as you know, those cycles operate according to their terms and not to ours. The late Reverend Kenneth Patton wrote a meditation for one of our earlier hymnals that contained the words, "Death is permission given to other life." He was stating in a very poetic kind of way the oldest law on earth, which is that certain forms of life die, including the forms we human beings happen to take, in order for life to happen. Our earliest human ancestors recognized this, and they developed ceremonies and rituals, and they created their symbols and told their stories to acknowledge and to affirm this process, die and live. And much later, as Christianity began its spread and its movement across Europe, some of these observances and symbols became incorporated into how the Jesus story came to be told and celebrated. And those symbols got all kind of mixed in together, which is why the date for the highest holy day on the Christian calendar is tied to the spring equinox, even though the accounts of that story had very little to do with the changing of the seasons. And it's why, intermingled with stories and symbols of a dying and rising Savior, we get symbols also like eggs and rabbits. The very term Easter itself has its origin in the name of an ancient fertility goddess. The word estrogen is of the same origin. So I'd like to use Kent Patton's observation that death is permission granted to other life as a way of framing up my Easter message for you this year. I find I think about this line, I go back to it when I try to assess my own take and bring my own interpretation to what I'm calling the Jesus story. For while the focus of that story, that legend, is obviously on the man Jesus himself, as I look at it, I find it's the disciples that I really find to be the fascinating people in that story. However many of them there were, the legend is that it was 12. They were rather ordinary, working-class folks who, as the story is told, were leading rather conventional lives. They were probably even getting a little bored with their lives, you know, farmers, fishers, that kind of thing, every day. And then along comes this rather quixotic and visionary and idealistic teacher and preacher who's going around the countryside talking about a coming new age, which he called the kingdom of God. A time when peace, love, and justice for even the lowliest members of society, the ones he called the least of these, a time when peace, love, and justice for the least of these would reign supreme. And these rather ordinary folk decided to leave their ordinary lives and take up with him. They became captured by his vision. And the story went on. Their leader gains a large following, so much so that he comes to be seen as a threat to the religious and the political authorities of their society. And he's captured, and he's hauled up before those authorities, and he's convicted of fomenting rebellion, and he's given a very painful and ghastly and excruciating kind of death. So what are the disciples, what are they supposed to do now? They were something of a ragtag bunch, really. They did not have any kind of a collective identity apart from the identity they were taking from following after Jesus. And the earliest written of the New Testament Gospels, which is the Gospel of Mark, probably gets it right at the end of that Gospel where he says they ran off because they were afraid. Now, most New Testament scholars agree that the account of the risen Jesus that is found at the end of the Gospel of Mark is actually a much later addition. The original accounts end with the disciples scattering, hiding out. Who could blame them? Here they had been devoted followers of Jesus, and after what had happened to him, they probably figured they were next, and they probably weren't too far off. So they ran off, decided to hide out and lay low. But then, something happened. We'll never know for sure what. But they decided that as frightening to them as Jesus' death had been, that they were not going to be defined by it. They decided they would take up his story. They would take up his message. They would take up his vision with whatever years they had left of their own lives. Jesus' death, that is, gave them permission to live a new kind of life rather than return to what was probably the humdrumness of their earlier lives. And that's what they did. Jesus' death became the event that allowed them to live a new kind of life for the rest of their lives. Well, many years, many decades later, as this disciple's story and Jesus' story came to be written down and codified, and if you look through the history of the first century church, there was a whole big debate about which gospels would be considered the official ones and which ones would not. All that process went on, and as that story came to be written down and codified, it became enmeshed in the worldview and in the mythology of its time and place, or what we would call a mythology of that time and place. For you go back to the Egyptian, and then to the Greek, and then to the Roman worlds, stories of gods and goddesses coming to earth in human form, and then dying and rising and returning to the realm of their gods, these kinds of stories were not that unusual. The Jesus story then, as it became a basis of a newly emerging religion, just picked up on a motif that was already out there. It resonated, really, with the worldview of the time and place in which it was told. So the attempts to hold to a literal rendition of a story that is told according to a worldview of some 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, I have to say it both baffles and bemuses me, but I'm willing to leave that be this morning. It is on the human level and on the humanistic level that I can relate to this story. For I find in it a lesson that we've already pointed to that the disciples had to learn. A lesson about facing the reality of death while not allowing oneself to be defined by it. For I believe that is the challenge that is also before us on this rather chilly Easter morning, as well as all the mornings that are left us in the lives that we are living. And I believe a resurrection occurs whenever and wherever we face and we meet up to that challenge. And so I'd like to offer you, for the remainder of the time I'll be sharing these ideas with you, I'd like to offer you two examples from the lives of two of my Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleagues about what it means to face up to and then meet this challenge of acknowledging death while not being defined by it. In our latest newsletter, I wrote wrote a little bit about the last several months in the life of my friend and colleague, the Reverend Forrest Church. Forrest is the senior minister of one of the largest and most vibrant Unitarian Universalist congregations in our association, the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. He's written or edited some 20 books, one of which I used last Sunday when I was using the Jefferson Bible to frame up my thoughts for that time. He's written or edited some 20 books. He's an outstanding parish minister. He is also one of the more articulate spokespersons for liberal religion in the public square today, I would say. And last October, Forrest was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, told that he had about just a few months left to live. He's about 3 or 4 years younger than I am. And then, following a round of surgery and after some further testing and some further diagnosis, he didn't exactly get a resurrection, but he got an extended reprieve. It turned out the initial diagnosis was not near as grim as originally thought when they actually went in and did some work on it. His cancer does not disappear, but it does not pose the immediate threat that it initially appeared to do. Well, the duties of the senior minister at All Souls have been assumed by another member of their ministerial staff, and Forrest delivers now one sermon per month. And his sermon just this past March, a month ago, was titled Unfinished Business, and I was very taken by it. I'm going to read just a little bit of it to you. If you want to see the whole thing, it's on the All Souls website. For in this sermon, he goes on, first of all, he relates sort of what it was like to have gone from figuring he was a dead man walking to finding out that he still had some walking yet to do. And then towards the end of the sermon, here's some of what he said. Whenever our time comes, our lives end in the middle of the story. We leave the stage before discovering how the story will turn out. In the meantime, however, one thing is fully within our power. We can take care of unfinished business. We can make peace with ourselves, reconcile where possible with our loved ones, and free ourselves to say yes to the cosmos, to embrace our lives and death, to make peace with God, however understood. To be free to accept death is to be free, period. The courage we need comes before dying. When we face our demons, or reach out across a great divide to touch hands, it is life work, not death work, that pays the great dividends down the line. Death may come as a thief in the night, but it cannot steal from you the love you've given away, or the strength you've shown in facing life's hardships, or the courage you've proved in quelling your inner demons. And then he adds, so if you need to, put down that drink, or pick up that phone. You know what your unfinished business is. Don't wait until it's too late to take care of it. To be free to accept death is to be free, period. The courage we need comes before. It is, that is to say, an acknowledgement and an acceptance of our finitude, our mortality, that frees us and gives us the courage to live the lives we need to be living. It is the finality of death that gives us permission to live the lives we know we can lead if we have the courage to live them. And to come to know this is to experience a rebirth. The other colleague of which I speak is one I know I've been referring to quite frequently in recent months because he's been on my mind, and that's Rick Manson. Many of you know I've been collaborating with him on a book about his unique 40-year ministry both within and beyond our Unitarian Universalist community. He lives in just south of Carmel, California. We're moving along on that. In fact, I want to show you this, and I've put another picture of it on the bulletin board in our... When you go to coffee hours, you can see it. This is the cover of the book that Dick Widger very beautifully and graciously has designed for that. So take a look at that when you go into your coffee hour today. Well, Rick and I are working on this thing. I'm, as many of you know, in the face of his dealing with terminal prostate cancer. He's been dealing with it for the past 8 years, with his PSA numbers going up and then down, and now they're creeping back up again. But in our correspondence of just the past couple of weeks, I've been given yet another example of what it means to acknowledge death without being defined by it. From one of our email messages, Rick asked if I thought we could get our book out by this September, which I believe we can, because he's planning another East Coast tour for that. I don't know if we could have it by that. His tour will mostly be down in the New York City area because that's where two of his daughters live. One's on Long Island, one's in New Jersey. We've talked a little bit about him coming up this way as well. We're not quite sure if we can make that happen yet, but we'll let you know. Of course, we're not even sure that the tour itself will happen. But Rick plans his life as if it will. He has used his death diagnosis as a permission to live the life he has as fully as he can for as long as it is to live. Again, acknowledge it, but don't be defined by it. And in thinking on this, I went back to one of his poems that we're using in the concluding chapter of this book. I think I read one of his last chapter poems a few weeks ago. This is another one. I asked him if he wanted to write the last chapter for this, and instead he sent me a bunch of poems and said, just work these in with some commentary in between. This is my how I want to end this thing up. I said, fine. This poem is called End Line. It was inspired by an email message he got from a fellow cancer survivor and combatant. End Line. I wish I could read poetry the way Rick does, but you just have to kind of indulge me on that. I've always been a yin-yang, front-back, clear-blur, up-down, life-death kind of guy. My own particular duality being philosopher slash hypochondriac. Win-win characteristics when you've been diagnosed with a life-threatening disease. Finally, the hypochondriac has more windmills to tilt at. The philosopher arming himself with exactly the proper petard. An explosive statement found in an email message beneath the signature of a cancer combatant's name. A perfect end line, wide and wise. Quote, I ask God, how much time do I have before I die? Enough to make a difference, God replied. Well, that I would suggest to you, my friends, on this Easter day, and on all the days we each and all shall live, is who we are. We are persons, each and all, with enough time to make a difference. And that is all life gives any of us, actually. Time to make a difference. A difference in our personal lives, a difference in the relationships we share with the lives of people who are closest to us. Enough time to make a difference in a world that calls out for greater levels of peace and love and justice. I think that's what that scared bunch of disciples finally decided they had way back when. They decided they still had time to make a difference. It's what Forrest realized that he had, after what had to have been one of the most emotional roller coaster rides anyone could take. Time to still make a difference. It's what Rick Manson knows he has. Time to still make a difference. And to know this is to truly know rebirth. To know this is to truly experience a resurrection of the human spirit and a resurrection of the life force that is contained and housed in each one of us. And so as we celebrate a newness of life with an earth that is so reluctant to let go of its wintry ways, let us be about discovering how we can make a difference in the time still granted us. In our lives, the lives of those we know and love the most, and a healing touch. A very blessed and happy Easter to all of you. Let's sing together our closing hymn. Number 270, Day of Light and Gladness.